Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Barlow Planetarium in Menasha is celebrating its 15th anniversary, and I'm sure they have a lot of events. One of the big events is that they are welcoming astronomer, author, television host, and blogger Dr. Phil Plait to give lecture. He is an interesting guy. He became enamored of space when he was about 4 or 5 years old. He received his doctorate in astronomy at the University of Virginia, worked as a NASA contractor at the Space Flight Center, working with the Hubble Space Telescope, the wonderful Hubble Telescope, began a career in public outreach and education with the Bad Astronomy website and blog, debunking bad science and popular misconceptions. He will be speaking on Saturday, March 23rd, and we'll tell you more about that as we speak with Dr. Phil Plait this hour of the program. Hello, Dr. Phil. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, our pleasure. Alan Pesch is also joining us. No stranger to this particular program. Alan is director of the Barlow Planetarium, and whenever something's going on in the sky, Alan joins us. And we thank you again, Alan, for being with us this hour. Hi.
Morning, Kathleen.
Last time we talked, we were talking about Russia and the object that came from outer space with a giant impact. And Dr. Phil, I know that one of the things that you'll be talking about on March 23rd is giant impacts from cosmic objects. And I would like to start with those. Can you give us a history of those? Have there been many of them? What do we know about them?
Well, over the course of the history of the planet, there have been millions of them, countless numbers of impacts. But in recent times, there haven't been that many. It depends on what you mean by impact. Every night, if you go outside on a dark night when it's moonless, for example, you'll see shooting stars, probably a handful every hour. And if you add those up over the entire planet, you'll calculate that there are about 100 tons of material hitting the Earth every day. That's rough, but on average, that's about right. And those are typically grains of sand or smaller. They're tiny. There's just a lot of them. The problem is when you have something that's a lot bigger and it comes in, and basically it can either detonate in the Earth's atmosphere, like the one over Russia did in February, or it can impact the ground and release its energy and explode like a bomb. And the last time this happened that was of any real size was back in 1908, again over Russia. And there have been others. There's a crater out in Arizona, a meteor crater. That happened about 50,000 years ago. And, of course, the dinosaurs were wiped out by a giant impact from an object that was 6 miles across. And that happened 60 million years ago. So it's a long time ago. But these things happen often enough that we should be not panicked, but concerned about them and thinking about what we should do if we see one headed our way.
Mm. Are you worried about them, Alan?
Oh, the time frames are huge. I agree with Phil that we need to be aware, but I think I'm going to start planning my days differently because something might hit us from space.
6 miles across. I didn't realize the one that wiped out the dinosaurs was 6 miles across. That's huge.
Yeah, that's much larger than Mount Everest, actually, when you think about it. And that's extremely rare. And by extremely rare, I mean millions and millions of years apart. We know there's nothing like that headed our way. And we're pretty sure that there's nothing that can wipe out life on Earth or even cause a global catastrophe headed our way even in the next few decades. But it doesn't take something that big to do damage. And that's what the
right.
Russian meteor told us. That was only about 50 feet across. And if it had been coming in at a slightly different angle or had been made of iron instead of rock, then that could have done some more damage. So, again, you know, it's like you said, it's not something you need to panic about or lie awake at night worrying about, but it is something that we should be thinking about for the long-term future, because if we do nothing, you know, it may not be tonight, and it may not be for a decade or 20 years, but certainly over the next 100 or 200 years, something like this will happen again.
Well, what in the world can we do about it?
Well, that's the question, isn't it?
Yes.
If you watch Hollywood movies, you lob a nuke at it. It turns out that may or may not work. One thing you can do is, for example, if you see one of these things and it's a couple of hundred yards across, the size of a football stadium, you can launch a rocket at it and hit it. as hard as you can. And it's speaking of football, it's a bit like when you're trying to knock a player down. You hit them as hard as you can to the side, and maybe you'll knock them out of bounds, and they'll miss the end zone. With an asteroid coming in, you do the same thing. You try to slow it down or change its trajectory, and it will hopefully then miss the Earth. And there are different ways of doing that. That's sort of the ham-fisted way. There are other more sophisticated ways that take a lot longer. Those are being looked at right now. People are trying to figure all this out. The point is, we don't have that ability right now, today, to do that. We need to invest the money to make sure we have all the bugs worked out so that we can use this technique, which we think will work. We just haven't tested it yet, so we need to be able to do that.
My understanding was that Russian meteor was something that nobody knew was coming, and it came through the sky, and I'm wondering if there would have been enough time, even if we had the technology, to knock that baby out.
No, not really. 50 feet is very small, and even though it made a heck of a display in the sky and a tremendous bang, from a million, 2 million, 10 million miles away, that's indistinguishable from background stars. It's just too faint. Even ones that are much larger, like the one that passed us right after that, which was called 2012 DA14, that one was only 50 yards across, half the size of a football field, and it was only discovered a year ago. So these things have to be sort of a minimum size and coming in the right way for us to see them at all. There was no way, essentially, to detect this this Russian meteor before it hit us.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you do, you need time. You have to build a rocket, get this thing set up, figure out the path, the orbit, the trajectory. And that takes a long time. It would take a year or more to figure all this stuff out. So the longer lead time we have, the better.
Does it take a lot of money, too?
Sure. You can't lift anything into space for, under roughly $100 million. So whether it's a feather or a space probe, that's sort of your minimum cost. It may be a little bit less than that. But you need to have that kind of money. You need to have the hardware available
right,
to do that. And right now, we only have a handful of rockets that are capable of carrying a probe like that out into deep space.
Hmm. Alan, do you think that we need to spend the money to do that?
I think we have to. I would prefer to have a plan. And as a planetarium director, I could go on for literally hours on phone calls I've got from people who are ready to sell their house because of a rock that might have hit the Atlantic Ocean and was going to cause a tsunami
really?
To wipe out Florida.
Wow.
And on my word, this wonderful lady was ready to sell her house. And I said, well, you know what? It's not going to – don't worry about it. Worry about other things. But these rocks that are hitting us, we need to be aware. And it's not whether – if it's going to happen, it will probably happen in the future. We just don't know how big it's going to be and how small it's going to be. But we have to be aware of it. And that's my biggest concern, which I like to tell people, is just – we know that this danger is out there. And we have to be able to react to it. And sometimes, as we can see lately in the news, reacting's not being too good for us in the political realm.
Right. So how did you reassure that young woman or older woman who called you and wanted to sell her house? What did you say to her, Alan?
Oh, I just said keep her, stay in her house.
Right.
And just worry about the stuff she can take control of. And literally the conversation came down, please wear your seatbelts.
Absolutely right.
And because this is the type of thing that you won't be able to control. And a lot of the times, and Phil talks about this a lot, of the Hollywood movies start this.
How do they start it, Phil? Oh. What's Hollywood done with this?
Well, movies like Armageddon and Deep Impact. Deep Impact was relatively accurate. Armageddon was not. But they just don't portray this sort of event very realistically. They exaggerate it, and they mess the science up. And it's not, from soup to nuts, just from the way it's discovered to the way they, get rid of the problem, it's typically not very accurate. And even if it were, it sort of plays up the scare factor of this. And it's not helped any by a lot of the media, which tend to go nuts when anything like this happens. And you know, you're right. It's there are people out there who are really scared. I get email like that all the time as well, and I have to say, look, you know, this is not something to sell your house and move about. It's you know, and even if we knew one were coming in, you know, you may be in an area that's safe, but it's not something that we are concerned about on a day-to-day basis. There are far greater things. Wear your seatbelt. Don't smoke. Get exercise every day. There are far bigger concerns. It's just that because we do know that these are out there, mm-hmm. and we do know that given enough time, one of these things will hit. We should do something about it. And that's the problem. We just don't know when this will happen. And it could be tonight, or it could be 100 years from now. It almost certainly won't be tonight. But as human beings, we have a hard time sort of internalizing low-risk or high-risk probabilities that have small odds of happening tonight or tomorrow or whatever. And so we tend to exaggerate how much we should worry about them.
Let me ask you more about the dinosaurs, and I want to know if you agree with what Phil has to say here. Do we know beyond a shadow of a doubt that a strike from a meteor wiped out the dinosaurs? And how did that happen? And how would we know that happened?
Oh, wow. Well, you know, the research I've seen said basically it all happened at about that same time. And you know, we have to remember dinosaurs had been on the Earth for 200 million years. That is way, way longer than humans have been on Earth so far. So they've gone through multiple extinction events or close extinction events. We do know that when the impact happened in the Yucatan, that either the dinosaurs were on their way out or it made them go out at that point. Whether that impact, that 6 mile across object that hit the ground, basically would have plunged the Earth into a what we now know today in the modern terms is the nuclear winter.
Ooh.
And that would have taken these huge animals that need a lot of calories to keep their bodies going. The food would have gone down, so the smallest animals would have survived. Mm. The animals that didn't have to keep their energy up as much would be allowed to survive. And then these large animals, which had ruled the world for hundreds of millions of years, finally had their way out. So it's really kind of fun because I lived in Florida for a while, and we can actually see evidence of molten rock that came out of the Yucatan that we can find in our ground in Florida, which is kind of fun.
Isn't that something? Phil, you want to add to that disagree
yeah,
with it?
actually, in Colorado, in southern Colorado, there's a national park where you can actually go and see the layer of clay that was laid down by the impact as well. I didn't know there were rocks in Florida like that. That's really cool. there's evidence all over the world of this impact. And there's a little bit of controversy over whether that asteroid by itself was enough to wipe out the dinosaurs. There may have been other things going on that were sort of impacting the ecological environment of the planet, and then the asteroid came along and basically said, yeah, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just such a tremendous event that cooled the Earth, threw tremendous amounts of junk in the air. Anything that was within hundreds of miles was probably vaporized by the heat. It also hit in a place in the Yucatan Peninsula where there happened to be salts under the surface. Chlorine and bromine are two chemicals that are present there, and those would have been blasted out into the atmosphere and would have eaten away at the ozone layer. So on top of everything else, the ozone layer disappeared and let through ultraviolet light, which would have upset the food chain. It's just one thing after another that really, really caused this mass extinction. You know, we're not too concerned about a giant impact like that right now. Again, because any object that's 6 miles across that would be on an intersect course with Earth would be pretty easy to find. We'd know about it by now. It's the smaller ones that are fainter that can cause local damage mm-hmm. that I think are more interesting. It doesn't take something that big to cause a lot of grief.
We're going to welcome phone calls for both our guests. Our conversation right now because the Barlow Planetarium in Menasha, a terrific place, is celebrating its 15th anniversary. Alan Pesch is with us, director of the planetarium. And coming in to give a special lecture on Saturday, March 23rd, is Dr. Phil Plait. Dr. Plait is going to be talking about, well, he's the bad astronomer, in quotation marks, and he'll be talking about what we've just been discussing and other events, too, some of the misconceptions, scientific misconceptions, and more. Our phone number for you to join this conversation is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Phil Plait also worked with the Hubble telescope for a number of years, and I want to ask him about how important that was to our knowledge of space and what's taking its place and all of that. That's coming up. So we'll be with you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now. Our lines got filled rapidly, so let's go where you want to go. We start with Ron in Bellevue, Louisiana. Hi, Ron.
Bellevue, Iowa. I'm not calling from
Louisiana. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. I thought maybe you were listening online.
I'm a subscriber to Astronomy Magazine. In the March 2013 issue, there's an article which says, How We Know the Age of the Universe. My question for you two astronomers, do they think that we know the age of the universe? Because it strikes me as like everybody thought everything revolved around the Earth. Then Galileo pointed his telescope at Jupiter and saw these four little dots going around Jupiter. Anyway,
all right.
That's the question.
Thanks for the call. Phil?
Actually, yeah, we have a pretty good grip on how old the universe is now. It's true that our ideas have changed over time. That's one of the strengths of science, is we learn more information. We are willing to change our opinion on things. And in this case, there's a lot of independent lines of evidence that point toward, first of all, the universe being very old, certainly more than thousands of years old. It's actually billions of years old. And in fact, when you start studying different objects in the sky, you can start to nail down that date of when the universe must have formed. And the current answer right now is about 13.7 billion years. Some of that comes from things like, for example, radioactive decay. There are types of elements that change into other kinds of elements through radioactivity, and that has a very definite rate of change. You can measure its change, and you can backtrack that in time and figure out when this all must have started. And from doing that, for example, you can determine that the Earth itself is about 4.5 billion years old. And that matches a lot of things we know about how the sun is changing, the age of the moon. So we know that the universe is at least that old. And then you start looking at things like galaxies, these collections of hundreds of billions of stars. You start looking at the universe in general, and you can actually see the leftover fire, in a sense. It's light. We call it the fireball from the Big Bang itself, and by studying that in different ways, it all points towards the universe being about 13.7 billion years old. Now, you know, if we find evidence that says this is wrong, the universe is younger, older, whatever, you know, pay attention to that, and we'll look at it carefully. But there are so many different lines of evidence coming from so many different fields, not just astronomy, but also physics and chemistry and other fields, that we're pretty sure about this age, and it seems like we can be fairly confident about it.
Isn't it remarkable? It kind of stops you in your tracks, doesn't it, Alan, to even think about the origin of everything and the fact that it's that old? I mean, it's just sort of hard to take that in.
I like working with students because you know you've really gotten to the students when a student, grade school, middle school, asks us, how do you know that? Because in a lot of sciences, especially early on in the sciences, the scientists would go out and gather data, take samples, do what Darwin did, and take the beagle to the Yucatan or to the Galapagos. Astronomers, we have to do this from a distance. We have to look at things and figure out composition. We've never went to Jupiter, grabbed a sample of it, and brought it back.
No.
But we can use spectrographic analysis to tell you that Jupiter is mostly hydrogen. And especially to Ron's question, I don't know why I remember this so vividly, but I was in elementary school, and I remember reading an article that we, at that point, there was an understanding of the age of the universe. But then they found this quasar that if they wanted to believe what they thought was the age of the universe, the quasar had to start shining before the universe began.
Hmm.
So that was the new yardstick of, oh, now the universe has to be this old. And we look at pictures like from the Hubble Space Telescope, the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. We're looking at objects that are so far away that it's just amazing. And I really like astronomy for that because it really lets us get into those questions.
I know. They're just these ultimate huge questions. They're wonderful. Thank you. And we'll talk about Hubble in a little while. We just have a lot of phone calls I'd like to get to first. Bill in Madison. Hi.
Hello. I was wondering if the guest could comment on one of the conspiracy theories that seems to go around that just will not go away. It's particularly bothersome to me because my father was a rocket engineer who designed helped design the Saturn V rockets that took the Apollo capsules to the moon. I have at least two friends who argue with me passionately that it never happened. And they cite as evidence the fact that you can't see stars in any of the photographs, et cetera. And I explained to them that the albedo of the moon as well as the Earth would have required an f-stop that would preclude the appearance of stars on photographic film. And they absolutely, I mean, there's just like this irrational belief in conspiracy theories such as that. And I just would like to hear the guest comments on that. I'll take off the
air. All right,
air.
Dr. Phil.
I have spent quite a bit of time
discussing
this moon hoax idea. Irrational is a funny word to use because a lot of these folks are swayed by some evidence that they hear. But then when you show them the further evidence that first evidence was wrong, they don't want to listen to it. And the caller is absolutely right. For example, one of the big claims is you don't see stars in the Apollo images. And the point is, well, no, because they didn't go there to take pictures of the stars. They went there to take pictures of the moon. The moon's being lit up by the sun. It's almost as bright there as it is on the Earth. And I say almost because the moon dust and stuff is a little bit fainter than the kind of stuff you see around on Earth. But even so, when you're taking a picture of an astronaut standing on the lunar surface, you're using a very short exposure time. You're stopping down the aperture of the camera. In other words, you're only letting a tiny little amount of light through because otherwise you'll overexpose the film. And to be able to see stars in those pictures as well as expose correctly to see the lunar landscape, you can't. The lunar landscape would be hugely overexposed. And it's the same thing here. If you went out on a dark night where you can look up and see hundreds of stars, thousands of stars, and take a camera and use the same settings that the astronauts did on the moon, you won't see any stars in your pictures. They're just too faint to show up. And it's arguments like that, there's a ton of them. We didn't have the technology, there's too much radiation, it's too hot, it's too cold, da-da-da-da-da-da. These arguments go on, and they all are flawed. I mean, they have to be. I know this because I know we went to the moon. But I have, in all of my years of looking at this, and of the literally hundreds of conspiracy theories I've seen about this, there has not been a single one which has really held any water at all. When you look at it objectively and clearly and look at all the evidence, you realize that these hoax theories are just simply wrong.
Why would it be in anyone's interest to say that we didn't land on the moon?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't necessarily have that knowledge psychologically to speak as an expert. I can speak as an expert on the astronomy and the science of how we did go. But there are some reasons that anybody can see. For example, some of these folks are selling books and videos and such, and they get on TV, and it's in their interest, if they want to publicize their stuff, to say that. But even if they, you know, that's sort of ascribing sort of con man motivations to them, and it's not necessarily that. I've met a lot of people who honestly believe this, and it's possible. You know, if you really thought the government faked the moon landings, wouldn't you want to tell as many people as possible? So it could be that their motivations are completely honest. But that doesn't change the fact that they're wrong.
Ellen, what do you think about this?
Well, my favorite story about this is I was visiting Space Center Houston, and they were unveiling an Apollo 16 diorama with John Young in it to commemorate his mission to the moon. And John Young, one of the designers told me, yeah, John Young took a look at it and said it's wrong. And, of course, that freaked everybody out. And on the back of the diorama, there were all these stars. And John right. Young just basically said, you know what? You don't see stars when you're on the moon. And that's somebody who stood there. And I don't know, and it's really strange on why we have this feeling that it didn't happen. I'm sure Phil has too. We've met moonwalkers, people who walked on the moon, and it's amazing being in their presence. We also have these other things on there called retroreflectors that we shoot lasers at, and the laser comes back, and we've been doing that since the Apollo era and measuring the distance to the moon, and those had to get up there somewhere, somehow.
Uh-huh.
And finally, a couple of years ago, we finally got images back from the surface of the moon that showed where our landing sites were, and you can see tracks and where our lunar landers were. So, you know what? If we wanted to fake it, I think it would have taken us a lot shorter than just a couple of years ago to actually produce some fake pictures to show you that we actually landed there.
Doesn't it drive you a little batty, though, when people say this didn't happen? Don't you just want to walk away and say, you're crazy?
Well, you have yes. to discuss with them the reasons why, what they're thinking. And the thing is, whenever they have really good arguments until you start going deeper into the arguments. And one of those is the photographic evidence. Oh, but there's no stars. Why aren't there stars?
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's look at the reasons why there aren't. You're right, there's no stars, but there's a good reason why there aren't, why you can't see stars on the Apollo images.
Let's go.
That's right. And
I'm sorry.
That's okay. He's right. And I was thinking, you do want to walk away. It is very frustrating, and these things never go away. But you have to. You have to look into this stuff. You have to talk to folks about it. And the real problem here is that for a lot of folks, this is not an evidence-based idea. The point is, you know, yes, we have pictures from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter of the landing sites. We have pictures from all kinds of things showing that we went to the moon. But the fact is, we have thousands of images taken by the astronauts themselves when they stood on the moon, and that hasn't convinced some people. So I don't think that any amount of evidence short of taking them by the hand and flying them to the moon and pointing at Armstrong's footprints and going, look, anything short of that is just not going to convince them, because this isn't something that is evidence-based. It's more of a faith-based argument in their heads.
Mm-hmm. Peter is next in Appleton. Hi, Peter. Peter?
Peter is next in Appleton.
Peter.
Hello.
Peter, can you turn down whatever the heck's in the background?
All right, hello.
Yes, Peter, hi.
Hi, yeah. I was just thinking, you know, I'm fascinated in space, too. I had a globe when I was a kid, like a world globe with all the star patterns.
Uh-huh.
And I'm thinking, you know, budget-wise and cost-effective, there are some low-tech solutions to the threat of meteors or asteroids. And, there's a lot of talented people out there that could help. And one thing we could do is build a giant baseball glove to catch the meteors. I'm kidding. And then there's an idea of building a tennis racket. Plus, you could get a football space kicker. These are just low-tech, cost-effective ideas we really should consider, you know? Okay, that's all I have to say.
Thanks, Peter. Phil.
It's interesting. There are no there's no shortage of interesting ideas of what to do about an asteroid coming in, and a lot of it depends on a lot of what you want to do to respond to the threat depends on what kind of asteroid it is. Some of them are metal, some of them are rock. There are also comets, which have a lot of ice in them. And not all of these are solid objects. Some of them are what we call rubble piles, basically chunks of rocks that are held together by their own gravity. And how you deal with something like that, and the size as well, and how much time you have, all of these things play into how you want to mitigate an impact. You might want to hit it with something. One idea is if it's a rock and you have 50 years, you paint one side of it white and one side of it black. As it spins, that changes the way it heats up from sunlight. And that can actually change its orbit
because the white side will reflect sunlight, the black side will absorb it, and that adds a very, very tiny force to the rock over time. This was an idea that was only discovered recently, that asteroids can be affected by basically the pressure of sunlight. And so there are all these ideas. They sound crazy until you look at them a little more carefully, and it's like, well, you know what? This is not such a bad idea. It might be cheap and easy, and if you have plenty of time, there's no reason not to do it. And if things get bad down the line and you need to take further steps, you still have time to do that.
Tom is next in Mequon. Hi, Tom. Hi, Tom.
I was wondering why, when you'd be on the moon, would you be looking out that you would not be able to see stars the way your guest has stated? And, you know, here on the Earth, you certainly can. That doesn't make sense to me.
All right. Why? Alan, you want to take it?
Well, I mean, whenever we launched astronauts to the moon, it was always in a phase of the moon that there was light on their landing area. So you had this super bright, well, it's a light gray color of the surface of the moon in bright, bright sunlight. And chances are, in that environment, you'd have to have your shade down, and you wouldn't be able to see the stars. Your eyes wouldn't be able to pick up the sensitivity of the stars because everything around you would be so bright. Now, here we can see stars on Earth, but we can't see stars on Earth in the daytime, just like we can't see them on the moon in the daytime.
Thank you, Tom, so much for the call. We're welcoming phone calls. Here's what's going on, in case you're just tuning us in at this moment. The Barlow Planetarium in Menasha is having its 15th anniversary, and they've invited astronomer, author, television host, and blogger for Slate, Phil Plait, to be with us. Phil is an interesting guy. He's written a book, Bad Astronomy, Misconceptions and Misuses Revealed, From Astrology to the Moon Landing Hoax. He has a blog. He talks all over the country about popular science myths and misunderstandings about space and astronomy, and he has also worked on the Hubble Space Telescope for some 10 years. We have to get to that. We will in a moment. Alan Pesch is also joining us. Alan is director of the Barlow Planetarium, and whenever big things happen in space and we want to know about the night skies, Alan is our guy. So we'll welcome our phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Ellen, this one's for you. We go to a Facebook comment from Aaron. Could you give good overview of all the special events going on for the Barlow anniversary? I worked for Barlow for the first 6.5 years it was around, and keep up with some of the other past show guides. Thought it might be a cool thing to attend and maybe participate in.
Well, our main thing is going to be bringing Dr. Plait in.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to be, because our anniversary happens at such a busy part of our year, the Barlow has been seeing a resurgence in attendance in the last several years, and we're not quite sure what that's for, but what we're going to try to do is, although our anniversary is on March 20th, is when we hit our 15th anniversary, we're going to try to do everything for our members and any special guests to see Dr. Plait on Saturday, February 23rd. And then we're going to be doing business as usual, as we usually do. We'll do, we serve about 25,000 school kids every year.
Ooh.
And about 10,000 of those happen in the last 2 months of the school year. So we are, especially at this time of year, ramping up into our super busy season.
Isn't that, both of you probably did this when you were kids, but my field trips when I was a kid, going to the planetarium was always way up there. It was such a treat.
Oh, absolutely. I love visiting planetaria, and there was one in a nearby high school when I was a kid, and I remember going to field trips there, and I couldn't even tell you how many I've been to now. I've even written or helped write a couple of different planetarium shows that have gone around the country, and it's just a wonderful experience, especially now. Well, I like the old style ones, too, that project the stars in the ceiling. I love those old machines, and nowadays we have digital projectors where they can show a lot more. You can show animations and take you close up to nebulae and galaxies. It's beautiful. It's a wonderful experience. So I can't recommend it enough. It's just, it's a wonderful, wonderful time, especially for kids.
Yes. Let's go to Terry in Mineral Point. Hi, Terry.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I originally was going to, I'll just launch into it.
Okay.
It won't take long. Have you heard of Dr. Michael Bailey from, have either of you gentlemen heard of Dr. Michael Bailey, spelled with two L's and an I-E, from Queen's University, or Queen's College, it's in Northern Ireland. He's famous mostly for being a pioneer of dendrochronology, but he's also written several books, and the lecture I saw was about comets and asteroids. He believes that there were many, many comet events or asteroid events in the past, leading to some of the great plagues of history, the plague of Justinian, the the Black Death. I found him fascinating. I have no idea how much science is behind him, but he is a doctor at a university.
Dr. Phil, are you familiar with him?
Yeah, I've read some of the accounts of what he claims, that a lot of historical events are explained by small asteroid and comet impacts. I have a fairly hard time swallowing that, simply because if they happen that often, we'd have more evidence of it. We don't see these impacts happening that often in recent history, and we're still talking about recent history just the past couple of thousand years. There would be more evidence of it, and we don't see that. And I think it's also one of these things, it's an idea looking for evidence as opposed to the evidence pointing toward an idea. There are lots and lots and lots of books and things written using astronomical catastrophes to explain historical events, but we know sometimes things just happen. You know, people lose wars, there are floods, there are famines, and you don't need to rely on an asteroid impact or something like that to trigger it. So without any sort of evidence, it's an interesting idea, but without any more evidence than just, hey, this kind of matches what people said back then. You know, I need meteorites. I need some sort of meteorological evidence, something like that, something we can sink our teeth into that actually shows that these things could have happened other than just historical accounts from what are essentially unreliable witnesses. Mm.
Thanks, Terry, very much for your call. Here's an email that's come in, whoever wants to take this. Did the impact of the Yucatan asteroid have any effect on the Earth's rotation and orbit? This is from John.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's a good question. I get that a lot, actually. As a matter of fact, I just had it the other day.
Really?
The answer is essentially no, because the way to think of it is that these things, they seem big to us as humans, but compared to the Earth, they're tiny, tiny, tiny. You're talking about, like, the Tunguska event was an object that was probably 30 to 50 yards across. So the size of, somebody's backyard, or smaller than an office building or something like that, or I guess about as big as an office building. But the Earth is 8,000 miles across. So it would affect the Earth's rotation like a bacterium landing on your skin would affect your own motion as you're walking across the street. It would take thousands or millions and millions of impacts like this to have any sort of real effect on the Earth, at least as far as, you know, the rotation or the orbit around the sun. They can have profound effects on our weather or things like that, but on, you know, the Earth itself as a whole, really nothing you could measure.
Mm-hmm. Fred is calling. Hi, Fred.
Hi, Kathleen. I love the show today, as always. I just wanted to say, a couple years ago, Pluto was demoted, and maybe it'll come back now. Maybe some big body will decree that it's once again a planet. But doesn't this kind of... These decrees about the status or rehabilitation or kind of demotion of something that was considered truth, like Pluto, doesn't that kind of water down the distinction between evidence-based and faith-based? Doesn't it lead to a kind of cynicism about science?
Alan.
So that's my question.
All right, good one. Thanks, Fred. Alan.
Actually, I don't think it's such an edict, because Pluto, we haven't had a good definition for a definition of a planet for literally centuries. And when we discovered Pluto back in 1930, in fact, we just went past Pluto's anniversary of its discovery by Clyde Tombaugh, we thought that Pluto was about the size of the Earth. So it made sense to call it a planet. And as our technology increased, the size of Pluto kept getting smaller and smaller. In fact, one wiseacre mathematician physicist actually calculated when Pluto should just disappear, because that's how fast the measurements were coming down. So right now, in that demotion being Plutoed happened in 2006, right now we have a new category of planets called dwarf planets. And frankly, Pluto's not even the biggest dwarf planet anymore. We have a planet that's actually bigger than Pluto, or a dwarf planet that's bigger than Pluto called Eris. So I think what happened with Pluto is for us to finalize and get a little better definition of what we needed a planet to be, whether it's size, whether it's orbit, whether it crosses another planet's orbit. And I think that definition helped us with it. We weren't just trying to be mean to Pluto.
I want to talk just a little bit about Hubble, because I know you worked for a number of years, Phil, on Hubble. I always thought that pictures from Hubble should have been on the front page of every newspaper in the country every day, because they were extraordinary pictures and we didn't see as many of them as we should. The contribution of Hubble to our understanding of space and the new wave of technology that may be allowing us to go even further.
Yeah, it's funny. A lot of Hubble images are really just jaw-droppingly beautiful. They wouldn't come out every day, but I agree with you. They should get even more press than they got. Although, you know, heck, I have to admit, we enjoy a lot of press because astronomy just is such a gorgeous science. We get such beautiful pictures, and we do talk about a lot of profound things like the origin of the universe and things like that.
Yes.
Hubble, of course, is not the only telescope out there. There are quite a few others that look also in the kind of light that we see, visible light, but there are also infrared, ultraviolet, X-ray telescopes, radio telescopes, and all of these contribute not only to our knowledge, but to the beautiful array of pictures that we get from space. And we're not done. I mean, there are ground-based telescopes. Our technology is getting better. We're building better telescopes. A new radio telescope array was just opened up in South America, and we're building new space telescopes like the James Webb Space Telescope, which is far larger than Hubble. Hubble's mirror is only 8 feet across, which, you know, seems kind of big, but nowadays is considered kind of small. We have much larger telescopes than that. James Webb's telescope is 6 meters across. That's like 18, 19 feet across.
Mm.
And that's going to launch sometime soon. I hear 2018 was the latest date I've heard. That's going to look in the infrared, which is light just outside of what the human eye can see. It'll be very sensitive to extremely distant galaxies, to asteroids orbiting the sun, to planets orbiting other stars. And because it's so large, it'll collect a lot of light, and it'll have very high resolution, be able to see very small objects or objects very close together. And the images we'll get from that will once again start making headlines. So I'm very excited about that, even though it's still a few years off.
Mm-hmm. That is exciting. Fred, thanks so much for the call. Matt in Onalaska, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right.
Wonderful show, first-time caller. I have a question for you guys. I was wondering how you could tell the difference between the meteorites, if they were rock and if they were iron, before they were to impact. Thanks.
Thanks for the call. Alan?
Oh, boy. You want to know that as far out as advance, and I'm sure we could probably do some analysis from it from a distance, but boy, when we look at what happened in Russia last month, I mean, by the time we knew there was an issue, the sonic boom was breaking windows. And I'm not sure what other technologies we have out there that could take a look at this small to medium-sized rock, literally, and be able to do a good chemical analysis. Phil, do you have any suggestions?
Well, that's true. I mean, after the fact, if you can find meteorites, then it's pretty easy. You pick them up. It's like, this one's heavy. This must be iron. I have both iron and rock meteorites. I collect them, and they're pretty obvious. when they come in and you just see them burning up in the sky, it's harder. There are ways of knowing. For example, this one before the one in Russia, even before samples were found, we were pretty sure it was rock because at the angle it came in and the speed it came in, it still disintegrated well above the Earth's surface. Something made of iron would have probably survived much lower into the Earth's atmosphere because iron is stronger than rock. So there are sort of indirect ways of telling. And if you happen to see this thing while it's still in space, if we discover an asteroid, for example, a year in advance, we can observe it enough in the infrared, for example, that really helps, to be able to see how it's reflecting light, what kind of light it's giving off, and you can sometimes analyze the chemistry of the object even while it's still in deep space and be able to tell if it has rock or metal in it. So there are different ways, but the best way is, unfortunately, I guess, wait for it to come down and then pick up the pieces and take them to a chemistry lab.
Hmm. I don't want the hour to go by without talking about the comet that we ought to be able to see now, right, Alan?
Yeah, don't get me started, Kathleen.
Why?
The weather, you know, the weather here has been...
Oh, tremendous. Because of the... You can't see anything,
no,
of course. Okay.
A sliver of sky off to the west. It's only going to get about not more than 15 degrees above the western horizon.
Oh.
And it's been raining all weekend here.
Oh.
I did see some reports, thanks to Phil's Facebook, that there was a great picture he had on Facebook from Tucson. And
right.
It was really nice. But I've been searching the last... when it was clear, and I haven't been able to get an eyeball on it. Phil, have you had any luck?
I checked last night. It was actually clear here, but our clouds come in from the west, so there's a lot of haze and junk in the atmosphere, and I didn't see it. But a lot of people are reporting that they're seeing it. I'm hoping to try again tonight. It's in Boulder. We tend to get nice, clear weather here at this time of year. This comet's called Pan-STARRS, and it has a funny name. It's named after the observatory that found it. And it was actually discovered a couple of years ago, but it just passed its closest approach to the sun yesterday, and it's heading out back out into deep space. But the path it's taking it is going to take it sort of kind not really near the Earth, but it's basically as close as it's going to get right now. So if you go out after sunset, if anybody you know listening has nice weather out there, right after sunset, as soon as it starts to get dark, it'll be low in the west. Tomorrow on the 12th and on the 13th, it'll be easier to spot because the very thin crescent moon will be hanging over the horizon. If you have binoculars, finding the crescent moon will be easy. The comet will be pretty close next to it. And if you look up, you know, something like, you know, nearby comet, how do I see the new comet on Google, you should be able to pick up a bunch of different websites. It'll give you instructions on how to find it with binoculars.
Mm. I feel like I don't ask this of many guests, but I need to ask both of you because I'm thinking I got to go to a website now to find out more information to see all these pictures. Do you, and also to get more information about how you're celebrating your birthday? Barlow has a website that we should go to, Alan.
Yes, just hit us at www.barlowplanetarium.org.
Okay,
and that will launch you to everything from our Facebook to our show schedule and even to Phil's presentation.
Great, and Phil.
I can be found everywhere. I'm on Twitter at Bad Astronomer, and you can look me up under my name, Phil Plait, on Facebook. And I write the Bad Astronomy blog for Slate Magazine. So if you go to slate.com, you should be able to find everything, actually, that we've been talking about here today.
Okay. And are there other websites, at least one, give us one where we can see extraordinary pictures from outer space?
Oh, just look up Hubble Space Telescope on the web, and you'll be busy for hours.
I'm sure you will. Let's take one more quick phone call. And it is Dave, who's been waiting for a while in Green Bay. Has to be quick, Dave.
Yes, there's a huge Oort cloud object that's been identified that will come very close to Mars, and maybe, in fact, even hit Mars. And in light of that, you know, we say, well, there's very small chances. But we didn't know about that until, I think, January of this year. And this is an object that's like 36 miles wide, or 50 kilometers.
Ooh.
So the V612 Foundation is interested in promoting a mission that will discover more of these, you know, these possibilities.
Alan, 15 seconds.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That, in fact, I think the best place to be for that interaction is going to be the Curiosity rover on Mars, because I think that object is supposed to go within 30,000 miles of the Martian surface.
Hmm. Oh, that was good. You did that in 14 seconds. Thank you both so much. You had great fun, and we all learned so much. Thanks, Phil. Thanks, Ellen, as always.
Thank you.
Ellen,
thank you for having me on.
Yeah, our pleasure. Ellen Pesch, director of the Barlow Planetarium, and we thank Phil Plait, who's an astronomer, lecturer, author, and creator of Bad Astronomy, and worked on Hubble for some 10 years. I love these shows. Love to learn about space. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning, who must also love to learn about space, for producing this hour. And thanks to Rhonda for on-air production. We're with you tomorrow. A couple calls about healthcare and how much it costs. And we're going to spend time on tomorrow's 9 o'clock talking about that. And we'll talk about Abraham Lincoln at 10. Thanks for listening.